Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Good afternoon and welcome to the seventh episode of Pixel Sift on Radio Murdoch, the student wave. My name is Gianni, now I do know my own name, and I'm joined in the studio by Mitch and special guest with the best name I've ever come across, Brad Power.
Hello.
G'day.
Hey.
Today we're going to be talking a little bit about acquisitions and the value of development companies and where that value comes from. We're also going to be speaking to Perth-based developer Paul Turbutt. He's the founder of Black Lab Games and his space-oriented combat title, Starhammer: The Vanguard Prophecy. We go through all that. Mitch, what else are we checking out?
Yeah, and finally, Johnny and Brad are going to let me know what I missed out on at PAX Australia last weekend.
I tried to twist his arm and get him to come along, but no, he wasn't able to do it this time.
No, I couldn't make it.
But there we go. All right, let's jump into it. You're listening to Pixel Sift on Radio Murdoch. So as we've mentioned in previous episodes, gaming is a huge industry now, and it is worth a lot of money. It's bigger than the television and movie industry. It makes more money than that year over year. And it's not uncommon, and it's becoming more common, for these companies to be sold for massive amounts of money. These deals often involve billions upon billions of dollars. And where do these massive values come from, though? You may be wondering. King, the makers of Candy Crush and other games as well, including Bubble Witch Saga, but Candy Crush is their main bread and butter, was purchased this week by Activision for $5.9 billion. And I thought it would be good to have a think and a bit of a chat about where the value of that IP and that company comes from. What do you think?
All right, well, so $5.9 billion essentially for Candy Crush, because let's face it, no one's playing their other games. So I guess what they're paying for is their user base, maybe?
I guess so. And that user base is huge.
Yeah.
So Activision, you know, they don't make silly bets.
No, they don't. But like it just seems like you're spending that money is not buying the game, because Candy Crush is not that substantial, and it's pretty much just a Bejeweled ripoff, isn't it?
It's a game that, I mean, that's one of the criticisms when King first sort of hit the scene and everyone's becoming popular with, on everyone's phone, basically, if you're not a hardcore gamer.
Yeah.
And even if you are a hardcore gamer, you probably had a copy of Candy Crush sitting on there.
But the thing is, they trademarked, I think, the word candy in regards to...
They trademarked Saga.
Oh, they trademarked Saga. Uh-huh. Mm. Okay.
And there was the indie game, the Banner Saga, who ran into a bit of grief with them. And, you know.
And it just seems like a really not a very fun way to deal with anything. Like, they didn't get any friends because of that. I certainly growl every time I see a King ad on TV. Like, it's like, just doesn't make me happy.
Well, if we want to put that number in perspective, the $5.9 billion, Mojang, however you prefer to pronounce it, was bought by Microsoft for $2.5 billion for the Minecraft, which is only one game, really. But I mean, there is Cobalt and Scrolls as well, which is part of the Mojang
stable. In comparison, seems like a vast discount.
Yeah, it's a bargain.
Yeah.
LucasArts and Lucasfilm, which is Star Wars and Indiana Jones and everything, including LucasArts, which is the game arm of that, $4.05 billion for all of that and all the merchandising rights and everything that belongs to the Lucas franchise. And Marvel was bought by Disney for $4 billion. So Activision, someone in the powers that be, has obviously decided that this is worth $5.9 billion. Where do we think this value is coming from?
I think what they're doing is they're buying an IP and actually an infrastructure into a market that they've not traditionally been successful in. So Activision are on PC, they're on consoles, they have some kind of ports of their games to mobile, but really they're buying an IP or a franchise and a kind of a maker of valued content. So King, I mean, like you say, it's mainly Candy Crush, but they've got other games as well, and they can churn them out to Kingdom Come, and Activision have now invested in that machine, right? So now they've got a toehold in an industry that they're traditionally not strong in.
Do you think this is a bigger step in what they're actually trying to do? I noticed that they've also created an esports division as part of their thing. So you have Activision Blizzard, and now they've got an esports division, and now they've got King as part of this. Do you think this is a bit more of a diversification of what they've got?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's an investment in new trends. So one of them is mobile and one of them is esports. I mean, and you could also say that Microsoft are doing the same thing, buying Mojang, no matter what you kind of attribute the values to, whether it's $2 billion or $5.9 billion. It's about seeing what's popular, what's trending. I mean, Minecraft is unstoppable. Most games would have died by now, but they've got this long-lasting, magical appeal. And I think Microsoft see the potential of that idea that you can build with that game. So I think both of these companies, and more, I'm sure we'll see more of this kind of thing happening in the future, are investing in what they see as being growing markets in the future.
Do you think King has got enough in it in terms of IP power and all that sort of stuff that they'll be able to churn out more games, or are they using this, are they buying the user base as Mitch mentioned?
I think, well, the user base thing is a definitely strong argument, but I think mainly people expect a certain thing out of King now, like with just the bright, colorful, very simple and elegant games that they create. Regardless of my opinion, they are simple and elegant and they work. People like them. So I think, tapping a market. Brad's absolutely correct on that one.
Yeah, and the other thing I think is that so many people, like you talk about the user base, that install base for King Games is so huge. If they're now partnered with Activision, they use that as a vector to cross-promote and advertise their other games. And whether those are mobile games, whether that's the upcoming new Guitar Hero, whether it's whatever, it becomes another platform for them to get their message out there.
Do you think that the user base that they get buying into is loyal enough to the brand? I would think that the majority of people who are playing these sort of on your phone short casual games would be jumping onto whatever the next cool casual game is, regardless of who made it.
I think a gamer, no matter how casual or whatever they play on, I think today's Candy Crush player could be the next Final Fantasy or like WoW player. I think it's the interaction with new things, and I think that as a marketing vehicle, Candy Crush is very valuable in that respect.
I would totally agree. I think that there's a lot of people that didn't consider themselves gamers that kind of got into, they end up playing Skyrim, but they start by playing Candy Crush or Bejeweled. It's kind of a bit of a gateway into a larger world of exploration for them. So yeah, I'd absolutely say it's definitely a toehold.
And if you can create stronger links between the casual sector and the, I guess, for lack of a better term, core sector. I mean, if you can create strong bridges that people can cross very easily between the two, even back and forth, I think that's valuable.
Yep, absolutely.
Do you think anyone else who might be on the I guess, in the sights of any of these big companies, either your EAs or your Activisions, anyone can we think of that might be in that sort of area? One that jumps to mind is the developers of Crossy Road. They're Australian guys.
Yeah, Hipster Whale.
Hipster Whale. I think they'll be on the acquisition path soon.
Yeah, I remember in the past few days when Activision announced this acquisition, people immediately started talking about, well, is EA going to buy Rovio, makers of Angry Birds, for example?
I think we've said in some of our previous episodes that I think maybe we've hit the peak IP.
The saturation point.
Yeah. The saturation point for Angry Birds. But
How's PopCap doing?
Yeah, you don't hear much from them. I mean, they
became part of the EA machine, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they're still churning away with the...
Because that Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare thing, that's pretty cool.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, like I said, like you could get, I guess, like Plants vs. Zombies evolving into the third-person shooter that is... I'm not saying that Candy Crush would make like a great first-person shooter or something like that, but I guess that kind of evolution is now a little bit more possible with the acquisition by Activision.
That's a perfect example of how they've converted their casual audience into and having a stepping stone sort of game with the Garden Warfare, with Plants vs. Zombies.
These bridges just are going to be formed now, I think.
And someone's like, oh, I love these sort of games. I'm going to play the next Battlefield or I'm going to play the next Battlefront.
And I think it also doesn't matter like whether... whether your conversion rate from casual to core gamer is only 0.1%, well, if you've got an install base of 200 million devices, well, that's going to be still a sizable number. It's just a numbers game in the end.
Great. All right, let's go on to our next segment. Let's have a listen to this. You can check out Pixel Sift and all the other great Radio Murdoch shows on www.radiomurdoch.com. Read blogs, check out the upcoming schedule, and listen back to previous shows. Radio Murdoch, the student wave. Now, if you're a fan of space combat simulators, and I must admit that I definitely am, you can be very spoilt for choice, because there are many titles that are coming out that are being remastered and that are sort of re-emerging in this genre. It can be difficult to stand out from the pack, but we've got some local devs in Perth. They're called Black Lab Games, and they've stepped up to the plate with Starhammer, The Vanguard Prophecy, which is their take on the spacefaring combat genre. Earlier today, we spoke to Paul Turbot. He's the founder of Black Lab Games, and they are the studio behind Starhammer, The Vanguard Prophecy.
I'm Paul Turbot, founder of Black Lab Games. Starhammer is a tactical fleet battle game. It's a strategy game using a kind of a hybrid of a turn-based and real-time system. Working on it, we actually released it. It's already available on Steam. Has been out since June this year. It's set in the, obviously it's a science fiction game set in the two centuries in the future, in which mankind's gone out into settled on a new planet out in the stars and come across a space-based life form called the Nautilids, and it's all about some conflicts and wars and stuff that arise through that exploration.
And what were some of the major inspirations for creating this game? What are some of the games that you thought of that have kind of inspired the way that Starhammer's come together?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily inspired by any games in particular. I actually took, more inspiration from other forms of media than games. It's influenced a lot by a lot of tabletop war games, sort of miniatures and board game type things, and also just generally my interest in science fiction of different forms. Just always wanted to create a science fiction universe, and so that's what we did.
Yeah, that's one thing I did notice, actually. It looks a lot like that Star Wars tabletop game.
The game's actually been compared a lot with the Star Wars Armada miniatures game. Even though we didn't deliberately set out to make it like that, that's something that people have likened it to. I think part of the design process when we were making this game was to try and make it feel a bit unique and a bit, innovative is a bit overused term, but that's definitely something we tried to do. It's make it not exactly the same as every other game that's out there. So it's not the same as every turn-based strategy game. It's not the same as a common RTS. So we wanted to focus on making it a strategy game where it's about thinking through, planning moves, making the right move at the right time, and that sort of stuff. But not making it, but also giving it a bit of an action visualization, like making it look interesting as well.
Is it a difficult balance to kind of strike between making it familiar enough and intriguing enough for people who like different things, but also not trying to make it too derivative?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a challenge, yeah. There's a few systems we've put into the game that were kind of fairly unique and we haven't really seen it done anywhere else. Like one is like a crew relationship system. So if you think about a lot of the big science fiction franchises, a lot of them they'll have core characters and these people interact with each other and they have relationships and stuff. So we tried to model that on your bridge of who your main crew members are. And depending on how they're getting along with their personality traits and so on, you get different bonuses in the battle, which kind of sounds like a good idea. I think it worked reasonably well, but a lot of the feedback we're getting is people not necessarily, immediately understanding how that all works. So we had to explain that one quite a bit, like on the forums and stuff, to get people to understand what's going on.
So a lot of games actually, like games such as RTSs and even turn-based combat, they rely on like a scissors, paper, rock kind of way to address how things can take each other down. Have you maybe avoided that, or maybe have you addressed that well?
Yeah, we didn't really deliberately approach it like that. I guess really, I think it was more, we probably approached it a little bit more like an RPG, I guess, in that each of the different ships that you can control were given like a class. So each thing is good at doing some particular thing. And then the enemies that you're up against, they have their own sort of abilities, if you like. And then just, I guess, just through playtesting, we've kind of tuned, you know, how much damage they do and how frequently they use abilities and that kind of stuff. So it wasn't so much from a deliberate design thing where we're going, well, you know, this is going to counter that and, you know, this thing counters that thing and stuff. It's just putting a whole bunch of stuff in there and then just playtesting and balancing it to get it to work out.
Have you found the feedback from players who are trying your game has been valuable in terms of tuning it into a way that's both fun but also challenging?
Yeah. So there was a beta that was, I think, that took place from about March until June this year. And yeah, we did get a lot of feedback and we did definitely do a lot of tuning as a result of that. I think initially it was just way too hard, so we had to bring the difficulty down a bit. And yeah, once we did that, I think it's been going better since then. So,
is there a challenge with, I guess, hitting a point where you're saying, well, yes, the game is finished now and we've tuned it to the point, or is there a temptation to keep working on it infinitely? And keep adjusting to what people are asking for and what people are providing feedback about.
Yeah, so certainly when a version 1.0 compared to the version, you know, 1.126 at the moment, there's definitely some differences in those. We have been developing it further since release. We added a new type of ship in the last update, came out about 2 weeks ago. And yeah, just getting the people's feedback and you know, if there's some user interface adjustments, for example, that make it just a little bit simpler, a bit more sleek and stuff, then, you know, we're definitely going to take on board those ideas and keep putting out, rolling out improvements. But there does come a point where you say, well, we're kind of done with this. We need to look at something, moving on to something else. So,
would you ever look at doing a Starhammer 2, or would it be something like an expansion pack or something like that?
Yeah, well, at the moment, what we're working on is an iPad port. And so that's kind of in beta at the moment. And yeah, hopefully that'll be out sort of later this year. So we haven't really worked out what the next project is going to be yet, but it's definitely something we're going to be thinking about pretty soon. Would we do another game? Absolutely, yeah. No question we would. Whether that's going to be the next game we do or not, I'm not really sure yet. We'll have to wait and see.
Maybe take the form and adjust it to a different context or something like Ocean Hammer and do ships on an actual ocean.
Yeah. I mean, you could do that.
Would you do anything differently in the way that you have approached your release, or have you learnt any big lessons that you'd like to pass on?
Yeah, I think so. Probably our biggest request we've had from people is for multiplayer, which we don't actually have in the game. And that's a pretty big thing to add in. It's not something you can do easily like after launch. So I guess if you've got a particular feature and it's a big feature like that, if you're going to do it, you have to do it before launch. You can't add big features like that after launch. I think once you've launched, you can certainly make small tweaks and improvements and stuff. But yeah, make sure all your big features are in before you launch.
And what advice would you give to aspiring game developers who are thinking about creating games and getting into this sort of industry?
I would say there's so many free tools and free assets and stuff these days that it's a really great time to jump in. I would say that the best way, if you want to be able to make games, is just to get the tools and just start making things, start playing around. There's so many like starter kits where you get like a complete game that's already basically been built, and then you can just start modifying that to you know, make it how you want, or see what works as you kind of learn the craft. And yeah, just jump in and make stuff. I think people can be put off by, you know, I don't know how to do that, I'm not sure what to do. But the information's out there, and if you've got the passion and the enthusiasm, then go and make stuff.
How nice is that soundtrack? That was Paul Turbot. He is from Black Lab Games. They have made the Starhammer.
Yeah, the soundtrack's actually a lot more epic than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, you need epic space battle.
You do, absolutely. Yeah.
It's very important. So you can check out all that if you want to get on. They are on Steam. You can have a look. They've got a stream as well. You can get on Twitch and have a check out of them. Worth having a look at if you like the spacefaring strategy games.
Whether PC, handheld, or console, Pixel Sift, Radio Murdoch.
So if you were like many of the game development people in Australia and also in the sort of Southeast Asian region, you probably would have made your way over to Melbourne last week. It was a big week. It was the Melbourne International Games Week. It started off with GCAP in the beginning of the week. It had Unite as well, which was another conference that was on. And then finally was the consumer PAX Oz, which happened last weekend. Brad and I were both there. We checked it out. We saw some cool stuff, and it was pretty good. Brad, what was one of your favorite things of being at PAX and GCAP this week?
Well, GCAP is a much more developer oriented conference. So as a games developer, I got a lot of sort of technical tips and bits and pieces out of that. But I would actually say the bookending kind of opening keynote and closing keynotes for GCAP were actually really emotional. There was a lovely coder by the name of Bree Code, an amazing name for someone that's a programmer, who talked about the kind of gender gap in games development and gave some really amazing examples that I think opened a lot of people's eyes as to why more females aren't involved in game development. And it's a really kind of a heartbreaking story that really just comes down to the way that computers have been marketed to boys, to teenage boys, and not to girls. So that really seems to me, it was so heartening because it seems like a problem we can fix. Mm. You know, it really seems like something where we can get, you know, there's obviously interest from ladies to make games, and it's really just about making the means for that to happen. So that was really amazing. And the closing keynote for GCAP was by a developer by the name of Martin, who's from Coldwood Studios. They're making the game Unravel, and he talked about how that game came to be, which was, you know, the product of a lot of soul searching for him and kind of, you know, even family and personal crisis. And out of it comes this amazingly sort of vulnerable game. And if you've ever seen the indie game, the movie, where Jonathan Blow, the creator of Braid, talks about putting your vulnerabilities into a game, I think it makes for such heartfelt games. So maybe one of the biggest messages for me that came out of that was not necessarily about games that are all about sort of smash and grab and blow things up, but actually games that are about, that have some heart to them. I think they connect to a whole new audience.
And exactly what Bree said as well, you want to get lots of different types of hearts in there, not just
That's the one type. That's absolutely right. It's not just for, you know, the kind of 18 to 25 white male frat boy. It's for, there's stories in there for everyone.
That's interesting because like if you're talking about like having personal experience being put into the games you create, but everyone that plays that particular game is going to get their own personal experience out of it.
Right.
And I love that.
Right.
That's one of the things that makes games great.
Right. And that's something that Warren Spector, so the creator of Deus Ex, which is one of the more sort of, I guess in the last sort of, it's 15 years old now, so I might as well say in the last 15 years, it's one of the more risky games that could have been put out because there were so many different ways for you to complete a level. This is not an on-rails game. You can't just... I tried. I remember when I first played the game, I came out guns blazing and I just got cut down. And it's, you need to try to find your own way of playing. And what they did there really was not at all dictate the way in which you play. It's not like Uncharted, which there's one way to play that game.
It's interesting when you think about how games is very different to your mass media TV movie sort of industry, but there's a lot of similarities in the way that you create these games. So your Deus Ex is probably not going to be your Die Hards and your, you know, big budget action film or your Star Wars or anything like that, but it might be sort of a smaller independent film where you can come into it, and when you're actually talking about it with your friends afterwards, you can be like, oh, well, what did you do? Or how did we experience that thing? Or I thought this particular thing, or I didn't even find this particular thing when I was there.
And I think what's especially amazing about that game is, like you say, it's not going to be the blockbuster because it's not telling you and holding your hand with everything that you do. And yet it won over 25 Game of the Year awards in the year it was released. So obviously players and critical review loved that game. And I think it heralded in, or at least it pushed into the mainstream, that idea of creating your own story, your own way of playing. And now we're seeing a lot more titles start to do that.
I think one of the best things about PAX and these conventions that we have is you get an opportunity to see some of these smaller developers who are starting out and who haven't kind of got the burden of having to deliver a massive quarter or anything like that, and trying to be able to create these more personal stories and a bit more interesting things and kind of, you know, explore and see these things. And I personally think one of the best things of that event was seeing all the work that everyone has done. And yeah, I feel great. I feel proud to be an Australian associated with the Australian gaming industry.
It's interesting how you mentioned Deus Ex as like you have to find your own path and it doesn't hold your hand. I played a game fairly recently.
it's Valiant Hearts, The Great War, and that is pretty much the opposite of what you just said, that it pretty much holds your hand through the entire way, and it's very on rails. There's only one way to do things, and it's very story driven, but I still got a very it got an emotional response out of me.
Yep.
I mean, that I cried about three times in that movie.
Well,
not movie, game. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So yeah, and so I think that's the beauty of it. I think we can even be directed upon a path and still get emotional responses.
Yep, I think that's absolutely true. So different things work for everyone. What I think is really amazing, though, is that ability to something that Bree Code said, which was that. Art is how we make a bridge between our dreams. So
yeah,
and how one person's kind of idea of something is communicated to someone else, and we actually form a bridge.
There's a lot of dreams out there on the PAX floor.
A lot of bridges in PixelSip today.
Yeah, a lot of bridges. What were some of the great things that you saw when you were out there checking out there?
Well, I think two things that really stood out to me. One was the sheer amount of indie games that were at PAX. There were rows and rows of them, and they were all amazing. You know, it was all killer, no filler. There were so many funny responses. People were laughing and smiling and really having a lot of fun playing these games. And the developers, I think, really loved the chance to show them to the public. So that was one thing that was amazing. And I think the other thing was the popularity of the tabletop section. You know, it's really that the show floor, if you've not been, is divided into almost, I would say, almost two halves. And one half is you know, all bells and whistles and lights and you know, epileptic seizures on the video game showroom floor. And you kind of walk into the other area and it's this calm, there's the sound of people throwing dice, you know. And
yeah, moving markers across the board.
Right, and thinking. But yeah, just I remember taking a photo at one stage of the entire tabletop area where I would estimate, I don't know, 100 tables worth of people were sitting there playing, you know, Settlers of Catan or, you know, Monopoly or game, you know, Ticket to Ride or just games you haven't heard of as well. And I couldn't even take... I almost had to do a panorama shot to fit them all in. There were just so many people playing tabletop games.
It's exactly how Paul was saying that, like, games such as Starhammer, for example, have those roots in those tabletop games.
If you look at, like, D&D, for example, the math is all there. Mm. I mean, it's all... the idea of, like, the modifiers and things like that, it's all there. It's found in World of Warcraft. It's the same.
It's a true RPG.
It's even in Destiny for, like... Oh, here we go. I said
right.
It again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, well, it's even in things like that. So... I think, yeah, we need to have a look back. And I think they've gained in popularity over the past few years, actually. They've just come back, board games and tabletop games.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think a testament to that is that one of the closing sort of shows that you could see at PAX was a team of Australian comedians playing Dungeons & Dragons, and they were joined by Senator Scott Ludlam. And it was a fantastic time. I mean, my face hurt from laughing afterwards. It was so hilarious.
There's so many great ways to tell stories, and people can kind of take it whatever they way they would like to take it, and yeah. I guess that's one of the options. I think some of my best picks of the show, I think one to definitely have a look at and was very fun to play, was a game called Inflatality. And if you see like inflatable noodle men that you see outside of car yards,
uh-huh.
It was a fighting game based on those dudes.
So it was all
like physics based, and you had to kind of like swerve around. And this is all, I'm doing a lot of hand movements. It doesn't work very well for radio. That was one of the ones to check out. Sortie was good. They've been back again for a second year. That's always very fun. It's very physics based, and you just die a lot of the time. Another game to check out, I thought, was a game called Western Press. Which is a short little party game, and basically you've got to do the sequence of commands, a bit like a Guitar Hero sort of game,
right?
But you do it in a sort of a countdown, and whoever gets through the sequence, it's like a quick draw game, like in the Wild West, and you make the shot against your enemy. So that was very fun. But there's lots of great things to check out as well. There's a huge range of fantastic games, and we're going to be chatting to some of those people in the upcoming weeks about how their game came together, what they did to create the games, and some of the experiences they had while being at PAX and learning stuff at GCAP as well.
So what's that called again? Noodle Men.
Inflatality.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Inflatality.
Inflatality.
I love that.
It's good. I like a good pun name.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of that. So yeah, there's plenty of great stuff to have a look at. Brad, thank you very much for joining us today, coming in and being the special guest.
No problems.
If you want to see more of Brad's work, you can check out some of the great Murdoch Game students. He's been helping them mentoring them and creating great things. You've been listening to Pixel Sift. This is Radio Murdoch's video game show. We're on every week. You can find us online. We're on www.radiomurdoch.com/pixelsift. That's PIXELSIFT. We're also online. You can find us on social media. We're at facebook.com/pixelsift. We're on twitter.com/pixelsift. We're on twitch.com/, you guessed it, pixelsift, and all other places there. You can listen to us live every week at 2 p.m. or you can get us on the podcast on iTunes. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have a chat to you again next week.
See ya.
Bye.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.